Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is BJ, and I'm an alcoholic. For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a serenity prayer. God,
grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen.
The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA simple actions. I will now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contribution. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open Big Book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we're discussing step 12A. I'd like you to join me in welcoming our panel this evening. You've got Dave and David. So I will read the first paragraph, which begins on page 89 of the Big Book. And then each one will share for a few minutes on their experience with the reading. So if you want to follow along, like I said, it's on page 89. And step 12 is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Page 89. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends, this is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. And we are going to start with David.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's David. Grateful to be here and grateful to be sober tonight. My sobriety date's October 24th, 1989. I was 28 years old when I got sober. I was 55 on my last birthday. I wasn't an old man when I got here, but I got to get to be an old man because of y'all. This is my home group. I'm a practicing member of the Simple Actions group, and I'm grateful to be here tonight. I'm not somebody who came here and thought this was a good idea. I didn't fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous when I walked in. I didn't feel like I found my family. I started drinking when I was very young. By the time I was 15 years old, I think I qualified for the program. You know, I had the I had the obsession of the mind. I looked forward to drinking. When I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking. And when I start drinking, I have the body that craves alcohol. I'm going to drink until I get absolutely stupid drunk. I'm not interested in being tipsy. I'm not interested in a warm glow. I'm not interested in catching a buzz. I like getting hammered drunk. And it's just always been that way. I didn't grow into that. That's just the way it was from the time I started. So I found you guys when I was about 22 years old by accident. I went to a little three-day detox over on Five Points, and I was just my little mission was to cool off for a little while, get the heat off, rest up a little bit, heal up a little bit. It was kind of fashionable. People were going to treatment back then. So I showed up in front of you guys, and I'm 22 years old. I'm incoherent. I hadn't slept for 3 or 4 days. I'm hostile. I don't know what's wrong with me. And when I sat in that meeting for the first time, it wasn't the attractive group of people I see looking back at me right now. The median age in the room was about 175 years old, and all of them were smoking. Many of them were on oxygen. It didn't look appealing to me. What they told me at that first meeting, they told me what I just told you, that if you're an alcoholic, it doesn't matter where you've been, it doesn't matter what you've done, if you had legal trouble or slept under bridges. They used the phrase Park Avenue to Park Bench. Didn't matter. If you got that body, once you start drinking, the craving will develop. It'll never be satisfied. And then when you put the plug in the jug, that's when the fun begins, because I'm carrying around a mind that'll talk me into drinking every time, and that's alcoholism, right? And the third thing that they told me that I did not believe was that I can't do anything about it by myself. So I just rejected all that. I'm one of the people who said, thanks for the information. And I went off and I stayed sober for a year all by myself, all by my lonesome. I got went back to the gym, went on a diet, got an aquarium project, and made everyone in my life miserable around me. And because I was miserable. Because what I really want to do when I'm so dry-y, I really just want to get drunk. So I did, eventually. And then I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for like 5 years. So what happened to me, and the reason I lay all that out is I didn't know what it really meant to be an alcoholic. You know, I thought an alcoholic was somebody who just really, 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 really liked getting drunk, and I qualified. I grew up with alcoholics. I think that has nothing to do with why I'm an alcoholic. I'm sort of a freeze-dried alcoholic, really. Just add liquid and watch me go. I believe from the first time I got drunk, it wouldn't have mattered where I was raised. I would have had a story to tell in Alcoholics Anonymous if I'd have lived this long. And so I showed up and you guys carried the message. I was hostile to the message. I made fun of you guys. I came in and out for 5 years. No, I don't want your phone number. You know, I don't want your little book. I'm not going to call you. So I was very ill and I didn't even know it. And the thing is, the people that I think on the people that worked with me, I came enough where I got comfortable just kind of hanging around outside a little bit, and people would just talk to me, and you guys would just tell me your stories. And I would do the yeah, but thing. I was argumentative, and you guys always just tolerated that. You always have met me where I was. So that's how I got here. You guys made Alcoholics Anonymous attractive to me. You told me to keep coming back. I wasn't sure what was wrong with me, but I just kept having to go in and out and in and out and in and out. And thank God for people in Alcoholics Anonymous that are awake to what's wrong with them and awake to the primary purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers, because we walk in here every single day and we don't look very good and we're not very personable. at least I wasn't, and that didn't seem to matter. You continued to carry the message to me no matter how ill I was. I absolutely fast forward. I absolutely have the experience that's laid out in here. Life will take on new meaning. To watch other people recover, to see them in turn help others, this really is a bright spot in my life. You know, I didn't want it to be. It took me forever to surrender to this thing. Surrender really is the only option of the powerless, by the way. You know, if you think about it in military terms or definition terms, if you have no power, you must give up. But I'm not one to accept that I have no power, and I'm not one to give up, you know. So So to be able to help other people and to grow into this thing has been an amazing experience. I by far, people in Alcoholics Anonymous are the most interesting, comic, tragic, wonderful people I've ever met in my entire life. And I love hanging out with you guys. You are the bright spot in my life. Thanks.
I'm Dave West. I'm Dave West. I'm from San Antonio, Texas, and I moved here 3 months ago, so I'm relatively new to all of you guys. I'll try to be brief. I'm not that good of a speaker. In fact, my wife told me one time if she ever left me, it'd be for somebody that gave her eye contact. You know, the first thing that jumps out at me about this chapter 7 is that it says practical experience shows that nothing will so much as ensure immunity from drinking. Because on page 24 in the big book, it says there's no defense against that first drink. And then we read here that there actually is. There actually is. And it's working with other drunks. And that's a great thing when you stop and think about it, because it's how the program grows, and it's what AA is all about, carrying the message to other alcoholics. There's another place in the big book that says, have we found a sufficient substitute for alcohol? And I thought it was talking about God when I first read that, you know, God and that God hole that's vacant in your life. But I later read on and found that what it's talking about, the sufficient substitute, is the fellowship itself. And it mentions that right here in a little way. It says in the second paragraph, life will take on new meaning to watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see fellowship grow up about you, to have a whole host of friends, and this is an experience that you will not want to miss. I tell you, I made the mistake of not working with anybody the first 10 years of my sobriety. I got sober in the year 2000, August the 4th, and I just didn't work with anybody. You know, I guess it was pride, a false pride, but what I've found is that working with other drunks is by far the most rewarding phase of the program, because you're able to work with these people and help them out of their seemingly futile state of existence. And that's the way it was for me. But I tell you, I worked with a young man over in Denver, Colorado, and my sponsor that I had told me, this sponsor, by the way, every time I went around him, he put me to work, you know, and I couldn't figure it out. I got to where I would kind of tiptoe around him and hide out a little bit, but he'd always find me and line me out to do something. And one day he told me, he said, you see that young man over there? He said, I want you to go introduce yourself to him and tell him you're going to sponsor him. And so it was a young Hispanic gentleman, and I went and told him I was going to sponsor him, and he said, great, I need a sponsor. And I started working with him, and his name was Alex. And Alex was a great guy. He was newly married, had a little girl, and had 2 years in the program, but had never worked the steps and was just coming to meetings and doing his thing. And I said, let's work the steps together. And we did. We got busy going through the big book. In no time at all, I saw this guy really was hungry for a new life. And I knew that AA was going to be able to give him that. And we did that first, fourth, and fifth step together. And the first thing on his list was that when he was 13 years old, his uncle had gotten him drunk and he sodomized him. And I read that and I shook my head and I said, yeah, what else you got? And he was able to lay that aside, you know, and forget about it, forgive his uncle, get rid of the resentment that he had carried for all those years. And I tell you, he took off. He had a little patio cement company that he poured sidewalks and driveways. And I watched him. Pardon me. I watched him grow, and his business took off. He got a job. He got a contract with one of the major builders there in Denver. And the last time I talked to him, he sold his company for $3 million and was back doing patios because he said it was too much stress. But in the meantime, he had cashed out, and he did it right. He paid his bills. He paid his men. He paid the suppliers. He got his permits. He did everything like you're supposed to do it because he knew that he was a man of integrity, and he knew it was important not to build up this stuff, you know, where you have to go back and do another fourth and fifth step on it. I tell you, he's a great guy. I consider him one of my best friends. And that's what this is talking about when it says that a fellowship will grow up around you and you'll be closer to these people than your own relatives. That's all I've got for now.
Thanks, Dave.
Next paragraph is on page 91. See your man alone if possible. At first, engage in general conversation. After a while, turn the talk to some phase of drinking. Tell him enough about your drinking habits, symptoms, and experiences to encourage him to speak of himself. If he wishes to talk, let him do so. You will thus get a better idea of how you ought to proceed. If he is not communicative, give him a sketch of your drinking career up to the time you quit, but say nothing for the moment of how that was accomplished. If he is in a serious mood, dwell on the troubles liquor has caused you, being careful not to moralize or lecture. If his mood is light, tell him humorous stories of your escapades. Get him to tell some of his. David.
What always strikes me about this paragraph is there's nothing in here that says take the cotton out of your mouth and cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth, you know. I hear people talk about that all the time. Sit down and shut up. You don't know nothing. You know, doesn't say anything like that in here. And nobody ever treated me that way. And what he gives us in the book, and it tallies with my own experience, is it's a beautiful model that we have here, because I don't know about anybody else. I was just going to make a generalization. I'll just speak for myself. I don't listen to people. I don't listen to judges. I don't listen to my parents. I don't listen to counselors. I don't listen to lawyers. I don't listen to neighbors. I don't listen to my teachers. I don't listen to my spouse. You know, I keep my own counsel, you know, and I take everything that you say under advisement. You know, I'll consider it. You know, I'll politely listen. But what you guys keep telling me to do is to tell my story. And when I look back, that's what you guys did with me. You didn't tell me what I had to do. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you just told me what you did. You know, my sponsor told me one time, a long time ago, he said, the only thing that you have of any value, David, is your experience, strength, and hope. And you're responsible to share that. If somebody wants your advice, they will ask you for it. And I'm still waiting. Every once in a while, somebody will call and say, hey, let me run something by you. It's like the angels sing. I'm like, oh, you've come to the right place. So, but it also just basically is telling me, you know, if this guy's talkative, let him talk. You know, if he's not talkative, you talk. But the whole object of the game is to share experience, strength, and hope so that we can get to know each other better and I can get an idea of how you might be approached. So, that's it.
Well, I think one thing for me that dealing with other people that I've learned, and I learned this in a career of sales, and that is be genuine with people. That's the most important thing. Be genuine. Be yourself. You don't have to get all excited. You don't have to make up stories. You don't have to really do anything except share your experience, strength, and hope. And sometimes that may be, you know, under wraps too. I know when I explain about the phenomenon of craving, I often tell a story that happened to me. It's totally ridiculous, but I'm going to share it with you. In 1980, I was working in the oil fields of South Texas. I was a derrick hand, and I got a night off, and I decided I was going to Corpus Christi, Texas to party. And back then, they had discotheques. So all of you who are above 45 will know about that. And, you know, you could go for a night of dancing, and it was big fun. And that's what I had planned to do. And when I got there, I said, well, I'm going to drink Crown Royal on the rocks, double shots. So that's what I decided to drink, you know, that much liquor in every glass. And, you know, I've always been a two-fisted drinker, so I drank as many as I could, as fast as I could. And the next thing I knew, they said, last call for alcohol. Well, I had a plan. And the plan is to go get two more. And in the 15 minutes that's in between them saying last call and the bars closed, I'll be in good shape. Now, I'd probably had 12 or 15 of these already, so I was good and drunk. But the problem was this allergy the big book talks about, this phenomenon of craving, it was working in my members, and I didn't realize it. And what happened was I got back to my table, and I drank the first drink, and it went down pretty smoothly, and I was just about to reach for the second drink, and the lights came on. And they said, the bar is closed. We don't care where you go, but you can't stay here. Well, like I said, I was reaching for the drink at that moment, and a police officer walked up. And the police officer said, come on, buddy, let's go. The bar is closed. And I said, well, let me drink this one right quick. I've got this, and I'll just knock it out. And he said, no, he said, you're not going to knock out anything. He said, let's go. And I said, won't take a minute. And I put my hand on it, and he said, young man, if you drink that drink, I'm taking you to jail. Now, I assure you, I have a relatively high IQ. But that night, I don't know what happened. Stupid got a hold of me, like David was talking about. The phenomenon of craving was working in me so greatly that under the threat of being arrested, I still had to take that drink and drink it down. And I slept on a cement slab that night, paid $85 for public intoxication to get out of jail the next morning. That's how the phenomenon of craving works in me. The scariest part about that is that I drank for another 20 years. I'll pass.
Thank you. The third reading is on page 91 also. When he sees you know all about the drinking game, commence to describe yourself as an alcoholic. Tell him how baffled you were, how you finally learned that you were sick. Give him an account of the struggles you made to stop. Show him the mental twist which leads to the first drink of a spree. We suggest you do this as we have done it in the chapter on alcoholism. If he is alcoholic, he will understand you at once. He will match your mental inconsistencies with some of his own. If you're satisfied that he is a real alcoholic, begin to dwell on the hopeless feature of the malady. Show him from your own experience how the queer mental condition surrounding that first drink prevents normal functioning of the willpower. Don't at this stage refer to this book unless he has seen it and wishes to discuss it. And be careful not to brand him as an alcoholic. Let him draw his own conclusion. If he sticks to the idea that he can still control his drinking, tell him that possibly he can if he's not too alcoholic. But insist that if he's severely afflicted, there may be little chance he can recover by himself.
That was the seed that you guys planted in my head, that I can't recover by myself, and I wanted desperately to recover by myself. I really wanted to figure this thing out. I thought I could move the pieces around, you know, I can see how crack is not going to further my business career. You know, these hard drugs are a problem. I got to put that away. I know if I crack the seal on that bottle of whiskey, I'm not going to work in the morning. But what about Budweiser? You know, what about a little Budweiser on Friday night, you know, with the boys? Stay home, not drive. You know, I got to keep making a deal. I've got to have an option out there. And I told him that at my very first meeting. I said, this is fine for you guys, but I require the right to check out of my mind occasionally by use of chemicals and alcohol, or I will in fact lose my mind. And they just smiled and told me to keep coming back or something sweet, you know. But I must have believed that, you know. I really must have believed that it was a requirement that occasionally I get hammered drunk. So I was raised a certain way. I have certain beliefs, you know. I think a man ought to keep his word. I think if I tell you I'm going to show up in the morning, I ought to show up in the morning. I think I ought to keep my hands to myself. I think kindness, you know, do unto others, all that stuff are part of my my moral fiber. I believe those things. And I can't pull any of that off. I can't pull any of that off. And as alcoholism progresses, I am capable of doing some heinous things, you know. I mean, things that disgusted me to remember, you know, often. I'm not going to do a fifth step from up here, but I would come to. I had my share of blackouts, which I never heard of a blackout until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought that was just normal to lose gaps in the evening, you know. What happened after Billy jumped out the window, you know? Oh, yeah, that's right. You know, you're just not supposed to remember everything. But anyway, I remember a lot of things as well. So I got to come to in full of shame and guilt and remorse and pain, physical pain, mental anguish. And I'd swear off. I'm not going to do that again. I got every reason not to drink, you know, at this point. And I think if I make this decision, I ought to be able to carry it out. So as the week goes on, I get a little more proud of myself, and the memory starts to fade of how heinous it was last weekend, and, you know, I'll write a new deal. Just a few beers. So I'm not a guy who drank every day for 35 years until his liver fell out. I'm a guy who quit 1,000 times. Dozens of times for significant periods of time. I wanted to quit. I had the desire to stop drinking 10 years before I was able to stop. It wasn't fun anymore. I drank all the fun out of drinking. But it was all I knew. It was absolutely all I knew. So, what does that mean to be a real alcoholic? So I kept having that experience. I just kept having that experience. And I kept coming to the conclusion, maybe they're right. Maybe they're right. Maybe they're right. And then I would come back and I'd think, they're probably wrong. They're probably wrong. And I just came in and out for all those years. I'll tell one quick story about the phenomenon of craving. I didn't know what was going on with me. And this is also kind of a stupid little story, but it perfectly illustrates what's going on. I was traveling with my girlfriend. We were invited to go up to her parents' place. He'd gotten a place up in Fenwick Island, Delaware. I was like 20 years old. And I drank with her father before. You know, we'd gone golfing. You know how when you're drunk, you think everybody's drunk. Apparently, this guy wasn't as drunk as I thought he was. But I had miscalculated for there. I don't have a credit card. I don't have any credit. You know, whatever cash I've got is the money that I have to spend. And I had miscalculated. And I'm up there a long way from home. And I am now broke. So I'm now at this beach house, uncomfortably sober, when the dad says, "And why don't we go out and get some beers?" And I'm like, I'm like a dog with his leash in his mouth at the door. Like, let's go, let's go. That's a great idea, you know. And so it was my girlfriend, her sister, her father, and me at this dive bar. And he orders a round of beers, and mine is gone like that. And I'm looking around, and there's or not. They've got a few sips missing, and they're talking about things, and I'm starting to have an out-of-body experience. Their lips are moving. I can't even hear what they're saying. I'm just I'm looking at my empty beer and they're full ones, and I'm thinking, my God, and I'm coming unglued. You know, it's like an endurance test. Once I start, it's got to go. I will take the pain. I will take the pain over having nothing in me over the pain of having two in me and not be able to finish the job. That's abhorrent. So I just absolutely miscalculated. I thought we were going out to get trashed. Apparently they were going out to have a few drinks and chat. And that was agony. That was excruciating, you know? So I never let that happen again. Thanks for letting me share.
What it was like and what happened and what happened now, you know. In 1993, my brother, who was an alcoholic, bless his heart, he was like a dog with a snake in his mouth. You know, he just didn't know what he could do to solve the problem. And he used a gun and killed himself. And at that time, I started going to AA because I knew I had a problem. You know, but I didn't get a sponsor. And I would smoke pot and drink in between meetings. And didn't work the steps, didn't do any service work. Just went to meetings once in a while, you know. And I did that literally for 7 years. 7 years. And, you know, I was just playing at AA. I didn't have a program. In fact, I got up one morning and I said, you know, if this is sobriety, then I don't want anything to do with it. And I went and got all the money I had in the bank and took it out. Don't ask me why. But I was going to do some serious drinking. And I went to my favorite bar, and by about 5:30 that evening, they'd had enough of me. And they sent me on my way. And I drove across town drunk. And of course, like Father John says, when you drive drunk, what you're really saying is, my drinking's more important than your life. I try to remember that. Because it's God's grace that I didn't take somebody's life all the times I drove drunk. But when I got home, I started a fight with my wife. Flipped the couch up on its end. She knew the drill. She just grabbed the kids by the hand and took them right out the door and went next door and called the police. And the police came, and by the time they got there, the couch was back on all fours. And I was watching TV. They said, you need to come with us. We want to watch you for 24 hours and make sure you're not going to hurt yourself or somebody else. And I said, no, I don't think we're going to do that. And he said, well, your other choice is you can go to jail. So I said, well, let's go to the lockdown. The 24 hours, no charges filed, just go for psychiatric lockdown. And we went to the Bexar County lockdown unit at the county hospital. And when we got there, they wanted to draw some blood and see what my alcohol content was first thing. And I said, no, we're not doing that. And they said, okay, have it your way. And the next morning, they served breakfast to everyone. And about the time they got cleaned up, the little bell went off and the door sprang open and everybody filed out. And right as I got the end of the line to walk out too, one of the orderlies grabbed me by the arm and said, wait a minute, you're not going anywhere. And I said, well, I thought this was supposed to be a 24-hour lockdown. They said, it is, but we can't put you back on the street if we don't know what your blood alcohol level is. And you wouldn't let us test this yesterday. So what happened was, I told them, well, go ahead and do what you got to do then, because I want to get out of here. I got places to go. So they drew blood, and sure enough, I was still drunk. And about that time, two Bexar County deputy sheriffs came in, and these guys were big. They were both like 6'4 and 6'5, 300 pounds, black jumpsuits, Glocks, handcuffs. You know, they were really intimidating. And they said, come with us. So we got in their squad car, and we drove across town.
And I thought I knew every street in San Antonio because I had run home improvement leads for Sears. And I knew all the cut across streets and all the neighborhoods and everything. But we came to a back street I wasn't familiar with. And we got there and there was a big arch. And it was that red 1950s brick, postmodern brick, you know. And it was, the sign was kind of falling down a little bit. It said San Antonio State Hospital. It was the insane asylum. They didn't call it that anymore. They called it SASH. S-A-S-H. San Antonio State Hospital. SASH. So we went there. They got me out. I went in. The first thing they did was issue some orange pajamas to me. And, of course, I put those on and the little foot covers. And they turned me loose. I went out the door. And there was a great room like this. Big room, high ceilings, probably about 150 to 200 patients in there. And it was the scariest thing I've ever seen in my life because these were really seriously mentally ill people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder that was out of control and borderline personality and all the different isms and personality defects. And I tell you, it was incredible. The effect on me, I really can't put it into words, but I was most scared because I could see that these people were bona fide crazy. And I looked just like them. I was dressed just like them. What if something happened and by some fluke, I wound up staying in here? You know, I drank my whole life to that point. And I had always said, you know, I'll drink and smoke dope for the rest of my life. When I'm an old man, I'll still be smoking dope. I used to say that. I'd never even thought about quitting. And I got a moment of clarity. And I know it was God who told me this because I never had thought this before. And it came from the outside and it came to me. And the thought was, you can live without drinking. I had never thought that. You can live without drinking. I'd never in my life thought that one time. You can live without drinking. Well, I took that nugget and they asked me to pardon me. They asked me to come upstairs and talk to the administrators. So there was a big table, and there were doctors and administrators and nurses and me. And we talked, and I said, you know, I'm just a garden variety drunk. I had a little too much to drink, and I got smart aleck with my wife. I said, I don't belong here. And they said, we're not so sure. We want to observe you until Monday. This is on Friday. And I thought to myself, oh my God, I've got to stay here for 3 more days and 2 more nights. That's 3 nights, isn't it? 3 and 3. And I knew there was no way I could do it because I was too rattled already. I went back down into the main area and I didn't know what I was going to do. I said, you know, to myself, so this is what it's come to. All the parties, all the bravado, all the women, all everything that I associated with drinking, it came down to a thin little funnel and it landed me in the state mental hospital. And about that time I looked out and my father-in-law had just pulled up and he had my wife and my 2 kids who were 11 and 9 at the time. And the 9-year-old has Down syndrome. He's now 27. At the time, he was 9 years old. And I was over by the window watching him. And the little boy saw me and came running up to the window. And he grabbed the bars without saying a thing. He just grabbed the bars and said, "Let my daddy go." And he rattled those bars. And everybody in the place heard it, and they all turned around and said in unison, "Let my daddy go." And they said it again and again and again. And it was like some macabre Broadway play or something. You know, I stood back and I said, I cannot believe this is happening to me. It was the weirdest phenomenon I've ever experienced in my life. Let my daddy go. Well, they did. They let me go with the custody of my father-in-law, who was an Air Force officer. And when I got out, I ran to AA because I knew there were people with 10 and 20 and 30 years of sobriety, and I knew it had worked for them. And I knew when I got that first word right, the we, I knew when I was ready to accept that, the we of it, that it would work for me. The scariest thing about that whole story, though, if you stop and think about it, is it all started with one drink. One drink. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Next reading is on page 92. Continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. Talk about the conditions of body and mind which accompany it. Keep his attention focused mainly on your personal experience. Explain that many are doomed who never realize their predicament. Doctors are rightly loath to tell alcoholic patients the whole story unless it will serve some good purpose. But you may talk to him about the hopelessness of alcoholism because you offer a solution. You will soon have your friend admitting he has many, if not all, of the traits of the alcoholic. If his own doctor is willing to tell him that he's an alcoholic, so much the better. Even though your protege may not have entirely admitted his condition, he has become very curious to know how you got well. Let him ask you that question if you will. Tell him exactly what happened to you. Stress the spiritual feature freely. If the man be agnostic or atheist, make it emphatic that he does not have to agree with your conception of God. He can choose any conception he likes, provided it makes sense to him. The main thing is that he be willing to believe in a power greater than himself and that he live by spiritual principles. When dealing with such a person, you had better use everyday language to describe spiritual principles. There is no use arousing any prejudice he may have against certain theological terms and conceptions about which he may already be confused. Don't raise such issues, no matter what your own convictions are.
Yeah, this in my case, this was all accomplished through going to meetings because I didn't really have a sponsor. I had come in and out, but I had heard your stories and talked to you at the meeting after the meeting. And when I think about my first real surrender to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 6 months abstinent of alcohol. You know, I didn't have a drinking problem. In fact, I don't have a drinking problem. I have a really uncomfortable sobriety problem. I really need to cure that somehow. So I'm riding around. Basically, I know two things. I'm 28 years old. I'm 6 months dry. And I know that I do not want to drink anymore. I absolutely know that if I start, I don't know where I'm going to end up. It could be 10 years, could be 20 years. And now I care. I used to not care. Let's just light it and see where it goes. But now I care. I don't want it anymore. I desperately do not want to live this way anymore. And just as strongly as I desperately don't want to live this way anymore, I know that I'm about to take another drink. I know what it feels like to be about to get drunk, you know, just like one broken shoelace. You know. So that was when I started thinking about suicide. Suicide had always disgusted me. I buried several of my friends behind that, and I don't throw that term around lightly. But that thought occurred to me, and I thought, you know what, that's a neat little solution. And I decided to jumping off a building would be the way to go. So I'm driving around the city of Norfolk looking for buildings to jump off of. And it's very difficult to pick a building to jump off of, you know, because if they're too short, they might not do the job. You know, and if they're too tall, I might have to spend a significant amount of time regretting my decision. I might be uncomfortable, and I can't have that. So these are my meditations. These are the things I'm thinking about. And then something in me said, why don't you go to one more AA meeting? Just go to one more AA meeting. And what happened at that AA meeting, nobody continued to talk about alcoholism as an illness or anything. All I know is a man welcomed me. a guy put out his hand and he shook my hand and he patted me on the shoulder and he said, everything's going to be all right. And he took the time to take me into the meeting and show me where the coffee was and make sure that I sat down and patted me on the shoulder again. He said, don't worry, nobody's going to call on you, you know. And he took the time to make me feel comfortable in a room when I didn't feel comfortable in my own skin. I didn't feel comfortable in my own living room, in my own company, you know. I hate myself, and you're not faring much better. All I know is I sat in that meeting that night, and I relaxed enough, and I was comfortable enough to hear what you guys were talking about. And I'd heard enough of your stories to know that you'd been where I'd been, and you'd done what I'd done, and I'd started to hope that, you know what, maybe, just maybe. I love what Dave shared, man. You don't have to drink. Maybe if I do what these people do, I'll get what they've got. Maybe it's possible. So then the very next thing that happens is I surrender. I am absolutely powerless over alcohol. I need help. I will do whatever you ask me to do. I need help. I mean, I've folded right there. And then just as soon as I fold, the ego pops back up and I say, by the way, I don't believe in God. And in fact, I won't believe in God. And the cool thing was that this paragraph, the main thing is that he'd be willing to believe in a power greater than himself and that he lived by spiritual principles. And the people who have led me around Alcoholics Anonymous made it very clear to me that the spiritual principles are not a mystery. We don't even need to know the definition of these principles. It's just to practice these steps. If we practice these steps, we will in fact have an experience with these principles in our lives and we will be changed by them. And the only thing that the man asked me to do, he said, can you stop saying, no, there is no God, David, and start saying, maybe there's a God? Just that much willingness. Can you bring that to the table? And I'm sure I couldn't have admitted it to him on the spot, you know, but in my own company, maybe at a traffic light, it might occur to me, maybe I don't know everything, you know. And I offer that because that pitiful amount of willingness apparently was enough, because I began to do the things that he asked me to do. I began to pray on my knees, you know. I tell the guy, look, man, I don't, you know, I've already told you what I think about God. And if I did believe in God, the God I would believe in wouldn't care if I was on my knees. He said, that's nice, David. Why don't you just go ahead and pray on your knees anyway? So I'm like doing a legal brief on my knees. I'm embarrassed in my own company. Like, there's nobody else there, and I'm on my knees, and I feel embarrassed. What is that? Somebody smart, explain that to me later. But I'm saying things like, God, if there is a God, you know you're a God. And if you're there, I'm sure that you can hear me, and you know that I don't believe in you. I mean, these are the kind of prayers. I'm insane. But the point is, I was willing to do the things that you asked me to do. And ever since then, I haven't had a sincere desire to take a drink of alcohol. So I don't know if that was a spiritual experience, but I know that I became willing to try something different for the first time in my life. And you guys specialize in something different. So thanks.
Thank you. Well, you know, it says we're not saints. And for some of us, it's been a long road. Sobriety's been a long road for me, too. I had such a deficit, you know, I was clearly, categorically insane when I got sober. You know, and trying to mainstream back into society, it's been difficult. You know, the steps, though, have brought me along. In fact, you know, my first sponsor said that it's a wonderful thing, these steps. He says the first half of them will help you with your alcoholism, and the second half will help you with your shitty personality. And that's the way it's worked for me, pretty much. You know, I can be around people and they can tolerate me now, but there was a time when it wasn't like that. In fact, you know, even today... Just the other day, a while back, we were in the car and we were looking for a parking spot. And I drove around the whole parking lot twice and there just wasn't anything available. And my wife said, why don't you just follow somebody out and then when they get in their car and go, you can get their spot. So I did that. I waited and directly an elderly woman came strolling out and she walked to her car, and we waited while she slowly walked to her car. And she got in, and she had to put some lipstick on. And I was doing pretty well for the most part. And when she went to back out, a car coming from the other way pulled right in there. And I jumped out of the car without even thinking. And I said, "Listen, you son of a bitch, that's my parking spot." And the guy mumbled something under his breath. I mean, I wasn't going to fight him right there. But I got back in the car and my wife said, "Honey, I know how you feel, but I wish you wouldn't do that at church." So, we're not saints. But you know, I'm 100% better person than I've ever been in my life. And I owe it all to you guys for putting up with me for 16 years. And also for this wonderful program that literally has changed my life and allowed me to have a part in all these other lives that we've enriched because we've seen people get sober and live normal, relatively normal lives one day at a time. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm going to read the final two paragraphs and have you guys wrap up with your closing thoughts. So the first one's on page 94. Starting with outline, the program of action, explaining how you made a self-appraisal, how you straightened out your past, and why you are now endeavoring to be helpful to him. It is important for him to realize that your attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part in your own recovery. Actually, he may be helping you more than you're helping him. Make it plain he is under no obligation to you, that you hope only that he will try to help other alcoholics when he escapes his own difficulties. Suggest how important it is that he place the welfare of other people ahead of his own. Make it clear that he is not under pressure, that he needn't see you again if he doesn't want to. You should not be offended if he wants to call it off, for he has helped you more than you have helped him. If your talk has been sane, quiet, and full of human understanding, you have perhaps made a friend. Maybe you have disturbed him about the question of alcoholism. This is all to the good. The more hopeless he feels, the better. He will be more likely to follow your suggestions. And then on page 96. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself. To spend too much time on any one situation is to deny some other alcoholic an opportunity to live and be happy. One of our fellowship failed entirely with his first half dozen prospects. He often says that if he had continued to work on them, he might have deprived many others who have since recovered of their chance.
I would call my sponsor to complain about a guy I'm working with. This guy won't do this. This guy won't do. And he would listen to me. And then he'd say to me, "Well, just remember, you do 12-step work for your own recovery, not for his." Yeah. And I, you know, the first half a dozen times I heard that, I thought, I got to get a new sponsor. This guy's an idiot. but anyway, that's this idea that we're here. I'll close with this. I know we're short on time, but I have the experience of drifting away from Alcoholics Anonymous in sobriety. My life turned around. I hadn't accumulated anything when I got here except debt. And I came here and I started doing the things that you guys suggested, and family comes along and children come along and mortgages come along and a business comes along and all this stuff. I'm a citizen now, right? And while I'm being a citizen for the first time in my life, my participation in Alcoholics Anonymous went down, 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 down. I never made a decision to leave. I never disavowed my alcoholism. I never had any problems with AA. It wasn't resentment. It was just shiny objects carried me out of here. And so fast forward 15 years of sobriety. I haven't been to an AA meeting in years. all that stuff is gone. You know, divorce is imminent, business is failing, children are indifferent to my comings and goings, and I'm back to riding around thinking about jumping off the building again, 15 years sober. So if I had a drinking problem, not drinking would solve my problem. What's wrong with me? I have a spiritual dilemma, you know, mental, physical, and spiritual with a spiritual solution. So anyway, I'll say this and shut up. When I came back, I was so destitute. I walked around to meetings. I picked up white chips at every meeting for a week. I didn't care if anybody thought I was drunk that morning. That 15 years didn't mean anything to me. I didn't care. It didn't matter to me. I wanted to try this way of life one day at a time. And I want to tell you that very few people came up to me. I was expecting to be swamped, and I wasn't. But a few people did, people properly armed with facts about themselves. And one of them asked me to coffee, and I went over there to Starbucks on 21st Street. We all know where that is. And I'm sitting there telling this guy my tale of woe. And he cuts me off in the middle of my tale of woe, and he says, "There's nothing wrong with you but untreated alcoholism. AA's full of guys like you." That insulted me. But it got my attention, because it was the truth, you know? Truth will set you free. It'll ruin your day first. But I couldn't argue that. I had untreated alcoholism, and he basically told me a couple things. I want you to go to a bunch of meetings. I want you to have a job in a home group. I want it to be important to that home group that you're there. Whatever that means to you is fine with me. He said, "And we're going to work the steps, and we're going to work them quickly so we can get on with the business of helping other people, because that's why we're here." And you guys might have been telling me that for 15 years, but that was the moment I heard that. You guys were here to keep me jolly. My sobriety, you know? Here's where I'm at, right? This is what I brought you guys for a long, long time. So what I want to tell you about that is that I recommitted to doing Alcoholics Anonymous and working through the steps with that man. And the message that we're here to help others is cleverly hidden on every single page of this book. I don't know how I missed it. So I'm grateful to have that understanding today, or at least have that be where my compass points, toward you and away from me. Thank God. Thanks.
Thank you. 1 minute left.
Sorry.
You know, I'm eternally thankful for this program, for people like you that are willing to come out and hear me talk. You know, I've shared my story with a lot of different people. I tell you, when it talks about don't give up on that pigeon you're working with, is that PC pigeon?
That's fine.
You know, I've got one sponsee from San Antonio, one from Denver, one from Westchester, New York, where we've lived over the last 10 years. And all three of those guys still call me all the time, you know. Anytime they want to run something past me, we talk about it. All three of them are still sober by the grace of God. And I tell you, it was worth the time. I worked with the fellow from New York, and his name is Michael. And Michael is 6'5", and weighs about 180 pounds. He's just reed thin. And he loves the Zydeco dance. He goes all over the country to these Zydeco parties, you know, and does it soberly and enjoys it. You know, he's a big commodity on the dance floor. You know, that's the real reward for me, you know, that and knowing that I get to keep doing business, and I get to keep my wife, and I get to keep my kids, and I get to keep my health. I just got a liver panel done yesterday, and the doctor texted me and said, you know, everything looks good. You know, that wouldn't be the case if I stayed at the drink for much longer. And I'm thankful to have my health and my sanity and all these wonderful things that AA has given me. And I hope I never forget the most important thing, and that's this. AA saved my life. It saved my life. And I'm thankful to a loving God for that. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
I'm now going to pass the seven tradition baskets. The seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, which is to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Are there any AA-related announcements? I have one. Oh, you guys can go first, though.
Matt!
Tomorrow evening, at the St. Andrew's 12 in Churchland, the St. Andrew's 12 Churchland High Street and Cedar Road, they're having their anniversary dinner tomorrow night. Dinner starts at 6, speaker at 7, Bob Edwards. There it is. Thanks.
Thank you. Ashton?
My name is Ashton. I'm an alcoholic. If you're not doing anything for New Year's, there are some people going up to Boston. We're driving. They're having a New England Young People's Conference in AA. I have 2 seats in my car, and I have 2 spots in my hotel room. So if you want to go check it out, see me after the day.
Thank you. Terry?
Hi, I'm Terry. I'm an alcoholic. This Friday at Church of the Advent, 6 p.m., nothing changes if nothing changes. We're having a potluck and a speaker at 7. Bring a dish with food, please.
Thank you. And this home group, Simple Actions, is having supper and a speaker the day after Christmas, which is obviously the 26th. It's Monday. 6 p.m. potluck, bring your leftovers, and 7 p.m., Al Jay from Buckingham, Virginia will be speaking. We'd love to have all of you guys. And grab some green flyers if you would. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Would home group members please raise your hand? Newcomers, is there anybody in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would love to welcome you if you feel like introducing yourself. Okey-dokey. There's literature available over there where the flyers are. Please see me or any home group member after the meeting if you'd like to purchase anything. Anything you can fold is free. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship in AA, I will be up here at this table and available to talk after we close the meeting. Please feel free to ask me any questions. Smokers, please use the butt can provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. So if you want to hear the meeting we just had, go to simpleactions.net. In closing, let's thank our panel. Thank you to all who participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on step 12 at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol, which is the Mexican restaurant on Colonial and 22nd. Could I have a volunteer to read the last 2 paragraphs up on page 164? Leanne?
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something that you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Amen. We have a nice way of closing.
New York accent.
Trespass against us, and lead us not into temptation.